You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 21st, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, USC Professor of Law Jody David Armour on the N-word theory, race, language, unequal justice, and the law. Also on the program today, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Rest in peace. Meanwhile, Trump primed to pick a replacement without delay. The question now is, does Mitch McConnell have the votes? And if he does, for when? Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi says impeachment is on the table, which could slow things down in the Senate. But she refuses to use the continuing resolution to stop a new Supreme Court pick. The ACA may be toast either way. Or it may be not. Half the states are on an uptick for new infections as the CDC reverses on saying that only that asymptomatic people should not get tests. U.S. says Iran embargo back on. Rest of the world says not so fast. Census could look manipulated, according to the Commerce Department, if Trump gets his way. And the EPA's secret deadline threatens tribal sovereignty out west. Meanwhile, Alex Azard takes control at the FDA, leaving everybody wondering if he's looking to relax standards on vaccines. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. Obviously, a very different situation that we're dealing with today than we were on Friday when we ended the program. In many respects, the worst case scenario of the Trump years is staring us in the face. It was not an unpredictable one. We will be playing clips or later in the program where it was predicted. I'm sort of shocked by some of the response on what we call the dumb left. I guess I shouldn't be that shocked because they're dumb. But it's also interesting to just watch the just unbelievable lack of accountability. Not so much that anybody's in particular is responsible for this. I mean, we're all responsible for it in some fashion or another. It's just when you are so wrong in what you suggest is going to happen, you would expect there to be some measure of humility. Maybe that is naive on my part. It probably is. This also, we'll take a look at this clip. I mean, the first thing that people pointed to when Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away on Rosh Hashanah of all times, was that there were, I believe, something like 17 senators, Republican senators, who had said specifically that we would not confirm a Supreme Court nominee during an election year. This was so that they could maintain some semblance of consistency with their dumb rule in the first place. Frankly, I think it's a stupid rule. You confirm as quickly as you can if you hold the Senate. And I mean, that's the president gets 4 years. This is their term. Even if you were to do it in the lame duck, you suffer the political consequences. However, the problem the Republicans have with this is that they disavowed that principle. Now, hypocrisy is probably one of the biggest losers in terms of politics that exist. I personally think it's silly. As a, you know, to the extent that it works as political rhetoric, great, use it. In general, I don't think it does that much. The people who want these things done, they want these things done because they are seeking power. That said, if I was running against Cory Gardner or Cornyn or Cruz or Graham or Rubio, not all of these are up for re-election, incidentally, but some of them are. Graham is. Gardner is. Cornyn. Inhofe, Grassley, Ernst is up for re-election. Tillis is up for re-election. Purdue is up for re-election. Tim Scott, Johnson, Toomey, Burr, Blunt, Hoeven, Portman. A couple of these extras are up for re-election. I would certainly be going out and saying they said they would not support or support confirming a Supreme Court nominee during an election year. And here we are during an election year, not even 2 months away from the election. But people generally don't care about that, at least broadly speaking. In other words, it's not going to stop Lindsey Graham. Now, it may hurt his reelection chances, and that is a valuable thing. Make no mistake about it. But here is Lindsey Graham in... Now, he's saying this in a Senate judiciary hearing in 2016. I'll let you hear how explicit he is about saying that if there is a vacancy during a, because he's trying to justify why they didn't even give Merrick Garland a hearing. But remember, and this is important because there's some dumb people out there who don't understand this. The Republicans controlled the Senate in 2016. They control the Senate now. That's an important thing to recall. They have the presidency now. They didn't have it in 2016. Here is Lindsey Graham in 2016.
This is the last year of a lame duck president. And if Ted Cruz or Donald Trump get to be president, they've all asked us not to confirm or take up a selection by President Obama. So if a vacancy occurs in their last year of their first term, guess what? You will use their words against them. I want you to use my words against me. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say, Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination. And you could use my words against me and you'd be absolutely right. We're setting a precedent here today, Republicans are, that in the last year, at least of a lame duck 8-year term, I would say it's going to be a 4-year term, that you're not going to fill a vacancy of the Supreme Court based on what we're doing here today. That's going to be the new rule. When y'all change the rules about appellate judges and district court judges to get your way, I thought it was a really abuse of power. And what you have done here is you've made the caucuses, the Republican and Democratic caucuses, are now
okay,
not
I don't need his moralizing after this. He wanted us to use the video and his words against him as you wish. But maybe he changed his mind. Maybe he changed his mind. Let's go 2 years later, 2018. I believe this is October 3rd, 2018. An important date for you to remember, October 3rd, 2018. I'll explain after you hear him reiterate what he said.
October being after September.
Correct.
If an opening comes in the last year of President Trump's term and the primary process has started, we'll wait to the next election. And I've got a pretty good chance being the judiciary.
You're on the record.
Yeah.
All right.
Hold the tape.
Hold the tape. You're on the record. You've got a pretty good chance of being the judiciary chairman. You are, in fact, now the judiciary chairman. That was October 2018. And I'll tell you why that's so important. Because here is Lindsey Graham tweeting out why he has now suddenly, but according to him, it's not sudden, changed his mind about all that. He has an excuse. Democrats chose to set in motion rules to change the stack the court at the circuit level, and they chose to try to destroy Brett Kavanaugh's life to keep the Supreme Court seat open. You reap what you sow. In other words, that's when he realized they're not playing by the rules, and therefore my comments on in 2016, and then my comments reiterating in October 3rd of 2018 do not hold because of what we experienced with the Kavanaugh hearings. The problem is the Kavanaugh hearings were a month before he said that on October 3rd. The Kavanaugh hearings ended September 7th, 2018. And he reiterated on October 3rd. Now, what is the value of that? In the great scheme of things, in terms of seating this justice, very little. But if I'm Jamie Harrison and I'm running against Lindsey Graham, it's really just a question of, is Lindsey Graham a liar? Is he lying to the American public? Forget about the politics of this. He's a liar. That may be worth a couple of votes. And that's a close race. But Lindsey Graham is desperate. Tom Tillis is desperate. Cornyn is desperate to a certain extent. Cory Gardner is desperate. Susan Collins just couldn't get away with it. She got released by Mitch McConnell because McConnell probably believes that he has the votes or coming or very close to it. So we will talk later in the program about the narrow opportunity there is to prevent the Senate from holding hearings. There's very little opportunity. There is some opportunity to save the ACA. We will talk about why that is in jeopardy. There's a hearing there. The SCOTUS is set to review the ACA. Even if John Roberts switches sides, you're looking at a 4-4 tie. That has implications. It gets basically the circuit court ruling holds, but it's a little more complicated than that. But there's something Nancy Pelosi could do to avoid that as well. But she won't. We will talk about that later in the program. It's just a very sad and disastrous situation. There were many people who, starting in 2011, and look, you know, it's unfortunate because we should be exclusively celebrating Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But the reality is, the implications for the living are greater than her legacy at this point. And sadly, her legacy, I think, is going to be marred by her decision to not resign in a way that was very safe for Obama to make a pick. And this goes for Breyer, too. I mean, there were calls for Breyer and Ginsburg's resignations as early as 2011. And then they were reiterated in early in 2013. And I'm talking by, you know, legal commentators who were worried. People who were actually in the courts and seeing that as strong as Ruth Bader Ginsburg was perceived to be in popular culture, you know, she was beginning to fall asleep during some cases, apparently. That's not the reason why you resign. And, you know, it was perfect. She had a lifetime appointment. She could serve that out, and she did. It is unfortunate that we're spending this time worried about the future so immediately and so intensely, and not able to spend the time sort of celebrating her life. But that was also part of her choice. That was also part of the calculation. There was a risk. Again, same with Breyer. They both, you know, you look at like a guy like Anthony Kennedy, who said, this is when my leverage is at a peak. I'm going to get my guy on the court and I'm going to step out. And now we are looking at, you know, this is disastrous in multiple ways. You know, one quarter, I think it was. Was it one quarter of Republicans in the Trump election? Their number one issue was that Supreme Court vacancy. So I wouldn't be surprised if Mitch McConnell waits till the lame duck, but who knows? It's really a function of how many votes he thinks he has. He will go for it if he thinks he can do it. Before we get to Professor Armour, a sponsor that was I was talking about. I'm wearing the socks right now. Well, we'll get into this. I think people who play any type of sports, really do any type of physical exercise, can understand the difference that like any small change can make in terms of, not just in terms of your performance, but in terms of your judgment. I mean, there's nothing worse than like, oh, I got a new pair of sneakers, I got blisters, or I got a new pair of socks, I got blisters, or whatever it is. Well, changing your socks can make a huge difference in your daily workouts, your daily walks. I don't know if you play golf. Runners worldwide have made Features their sock of choice. And now you can get the same benefits, especially tailored for the golf course, if that's what you play. Now, for me, I'm not a big golfer, but they sent me these socks and I've been loving them. Features Elite Golf Sock. They keep your feet cool, dry, and blister free while providing a custom-like fit that won't bunch or slip during your backswing, or frankly, when you're running around the park with your kid playing huckle-muckle, which incidentally, I beat him at. They've engineered a sock with targeted compression, anatomical design, and moisture-wicking material for unsurpassed performance. The anatomical design conforms to the left and to the right shape of your feet. They're left and right socks. They create an enhanced custom-like fit that reduces discomfort, prevents blisters, so you can focus on your game, on your running, on your workout. It's a proudly family-owned business founded in 2002 that operates out of North Carolina. Their mission is to create products that help you achieve your personal best. I was talking to Brendan and Matt before the show. I said, you know, these socks are actually really, really good. I'm wearing a pair right now. I got them on. I don't know if you can see that. And they're thin. I'm explaining to Brendan, like, they're thin, but they've got like padding, and they feel like they're wrapped around your foot, but it's not digging into my leg. And then Brendan came back with this. Brendan, say, I don't remember what you said, but Brendan's like, they're the best socks ever.
Yeah, I think they're the best socks for the best podcasts. And yeah, I run in them, so I really like them. In the way that Matt can talk about, you know, Sunset Lake, I can talk about Features.
That's right. So were you a sock skeptic at first?
Yeah, I had to be upsold at a running store for good socks. And I am a complete convert at this point, and a evangelical in some ways too.
I've already made the determination. I'm getting rid of all my socks except for these, because, you know, these actually, the black ones and these blue ones I have with the pattern on them. And these could be, I could wear these out if I ever went to somewhere fancy. Which doesn't happen, and they'll be far more comfortable. And in terms of just even walking down here today, they're incredible. It really, honestly, these socks will change how you feel about your socks, probably forever. And now you can get $10 off your first pair of Features when you use the code MAJORITY at features.com. It's F-E-E-T, Feeters, U-R-E-S.com. Use the code MAJORITY. That's features.com, promo code MAJORITY for 10 bucks off your first pair of features. Folks, you will not be disappointed in these socks. Really, honestly, this is like a revelation to me. All right. In the meantime, let's take a we don't need to take a break, do we?
Nope.
All right. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome to the program a USC professor of law and author of The N-Word Theory, Race, Language, Unequal Justice, and the Law, Professor Jody David Armour. Welcome to the program, Jody.
Thanks very much for having me, Sam.
So, all right, we got to start with this. I was talking to my daughter about who was a guest on my show. She's 15 years old, and now she's around the house a lot more these days because she's not going to school, or she's doing it from remote. And she's like, "You cannot say the title actually spells the word out, GGA." Yeah. And she said, "You can't say that on air." And I said, "Well, my plan is to ask the professor, like, what, you know, about that." And she said, "Well, just make sure you don't say that on air." And I think, like, it is, I've had a different perspective on the use of the word, even in this context, right? I mean, you've written the book, it's the name of a theory that you've been working on for, at least half a decade. Talk just about that word in the context of the title and your perspective on where it's appropriate to use that word.
Yeah, that's a perfect jumping off point, Sam. It is a blood-soaked epithet that has deep roots that run into a painfully racist American past, right? It's been used to denigrate and otherize and demonize blacks for centuries. And so I use it very advisedly and recognize that there's a lot of pain comes with it. But I also don't subscribe to the claim that any current day applications of that word are poison fruit. They're tainted fruit of the poison etymological tree that has roots in that racist past. I think that some black artists, for example, Tupac Shakur, Ice Cube, Nas, you know, Hope, there have been black artists who have appropriated that term and used it as a term of art in a oppositional discourse, right? In a political discourse, in which they're saying, we don't want you to just talk about us. We want to talk about ourselves. We're going to penetrate pop culture with an N-word laden discourse that's uncomfortable and disruptive. That's kind of part of the point of it, right? When I first started using the N-word in the Legal Academy, I used in the same spirit that Black Lives Matter uses disruption. Shut it down. Let's cut through our collective complacency about this festering issue. And sometimes we have to be disruptive to do that. And then let's compel some uncomfortable conversation. So I'm drawing on that Black Lives Matter spirit with this title to challenge us to disrupt our, you know, kind of calcified language of the academy when it comes to mass incarceration and racialized mass incarceration, and get down to the nitty gritty, how we otherize black people through language and through other means in this culture and country.
So I know there's obviously more to this, but I do find this topic fascinating. You know, one of my heroes, in comedy was Lenny Bruce, and he had a very famous, a bit where he basically said, we're going to disempower this word, essentially, I'm paraphrasing. And I think we could do that if the president came out and basically said, the president of the United States said, here is my N-word, Secretary of Defense, and my N-word Secretary of Housing, and my N-word this, and my N-word that. And he just kept repeating the word with the idea that we're going to demystify it. We're going to disempower it. And I mean, my sense is that perspective might have worked at that time, I guess. But in some ways, we've achieved a sort of like a different level of consciousness that it's not just intent. And I think this has happened for me, too, over the years, because
in very narrow circumstances 10 years ago, I would have used this like in public, in on the radio, to make a specific point or to retell something that I'm not so sure I'm so comfortable with today, just because of a different awareness. But so it's not just the intent. There is a whole set of criteria that contextualize it. Is that right?
Absolutely. I love that. And that's, it's part, the title is meant to provoke that kind of reflection all the time, constantly, ongoingly, right? But I like your reference to the comedian Lenny Bruce, because that's also part of the inspiration for my title, Sam. You know, the N-word, you know, some people say the GGA version is not the bad version. It's the GG, it's the GGER version. You know, that's the bad version. And in some way, when you hear a routine by someone like Chris Rock to launch his comedic career in the mid 90s, a routine called Bring the Pain, he goes back and forth in front of an all black audience and saying the following routine. I'll censor the N word a little bit in here. He says, it's like a civil war going on in black America, and there's two sides. There's black people and there's N words. And N-words have got to go. I love black people, but I hate N-words. Boy, I wish they'd let me join the Ku Klux Klan. I do a drive-by from here to Brooklyn. And he goes on like that for a half hour, distinguishing between lovable black people and morally condemnable N-words. And his core definition of a N-word, of a N-I-G-G-A, is a black criminal. So by that definition, Sam, the up to 90% of young black males, tragically, who are going to wind up in jail, on probation, or on parole in some of these inner city neighborhoods are N-words. We're willing to accept a political invitation implicit in a punchline that invites that distinction within the black community. And we all laugh at that. Amen. Laugh at the punchline and embrace it. So that's what this book is also about, attacking any kind of distinction between the worthy and the wicked based on a criminal record, even a violent criminal record. And I think the N-word is one of the words in the English language. It's unique in the English language. It's unparaphrasable, and it otherizes its referent probably more than any other word in the English language. So I want to attack that otherization. I want to eliminate distinctions between good Negroes, bad Negroes, lovable black people, morally condemnable N-I-G-G-A's.
I mean, in many respects, that Chris Rock performance, that bit, is really sort of the fundamental manifestation of, I guess, maybe the catalyst or the need for the N-word theory that you've written about.
That's it. You put that you hit it squarely.
And there's two things that strike me about that, and I wonder if let me see if I can articulate this. So it seems to me that what Chris Rock is doing in that bit is he is making a class distinction, right? And a class that is fundamentally economic. I mean, by class, I don't mean category. I mean class as the way that we speak about as class. And I wonder if... Okay, so that's one thing there, and he's making that class distinction in front of a black audience.
Yes.
And
yes.
Then I'm curious as to how that class distinction gets communicated and maybe transformed or within a broader society dominated by white people. Like, yes. You know, if that is a class distinction within the black community, what happens to that as it comes out into the white community as well?
Yeah, spot on. You know, what is really going on, I try to drive home in this book, is a lot of these moral distinctions are really class distinctions masquerading as moral distinctions. It just so happens, Sam, that when you look at the crime rates for middle-class black Americans and middle-class white Americans, they're roughly the same. So really, most of the folks that Chris Rock would be pointing to that are blacks who are involved in crime are from truly disadvantaged backgrounds. They're truly disadvantaged blacks. So what Chris Rock might just as well say is, I love disproportionately middle class blacks, and I hate disproportionately truly disadvantaged blacks. right? I love disproportionately privileged black Brahmins, the black bourgeoisie, and I hate the disproportionately truly disadvantaged black, because that's the numbers. You just look at you just crunch the numbers, right? And I even see it here in my neighborhood in L.A., you know, which I live in View Park. It's called Black Beverly Hills. And I've had some of my neighbors say, when I and some of my sons have had friends from other neighborhoods like Compton, Watts, et cetera, visit us, I've had neighbors say, we don't want Watts up here. We don't want South Central up here. Right. So there's an economically gated mentality that is developed even among the black bourgeoisie that I've seen point blank. So it is about both class and race. But the thing is, you can't reduce race to class, because as Stevie Wonder once said, you might make big cash, but you cannot cash in your face. And the face of crime for millions of Americans is black. And that's why you see so many black Brahmins, you know, the rage of the privileged class. Ellis Coase had a book out years ago about all these black doctors and lawyers who are high achievers who are still getting racially profiled, and they were enraged by it. So even though you make a lot of money, you cannot escape the black tax in that way.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, using my own experience, you know, there is a concept in, I guess, cultural Judaism, like this is good for the Jews or bad for the Jews. Like there is, you know, Bernie Madoff was really upsetting to, you know, my relatives, because it's bad for the Jews to have a Jew come out and do this, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like how much of that is going on in this dynamic, and how much does that dynamic then end up? I mean, I think you just articulated it, but I'm just curious to pull that out a little bit more. That dynamic where it's like, ugh, you know, why do you and I have to be conjoined in the same community? I'm going to try and cleave us as much as possible. But unfortunately, what happens is that comes back around and you don't have control of your fate in that context.
That's again, man, that's right on, because one of the things I drive home in this book is that there has been in the black community for a long time a politics of respectability. It worked back in the civil rights era, in which the black community said, many rather leaders in the black community said, our racial reputation in the eyes of whites is very important. We have to do all we can do to enhance our racial reputation in the eyes of whites, because they are policymakers. They are decision makers. They are deciding the fate of our community. And so we have to look good in their eyes so that they'll make favorable judgments when they're balancing those competing interests. Right. So that means that you have to, as a community, in the interest of the community, distinguish and distance yourself as much as possible from bad Negroes. If you're a good Negro, law-abiding Negro, you distinguish and distance yourself from them bad Negroes for the sake of our racial reputation, for the good of the community. Right. Now, Black Lives Matter rejected that approach, rejected that MO and that way of looking at the world. And that's why you had some tension between old civil rights establishment folks and BLM sometimes, right? Because BLM said, no, you know, a lot of these victims of police violence aren't morally immaculate, if you will. You know, yes, Eric Garner was selling Lucy's on the sidewalk. Okay. Yes, Walter Scott was running away from a police officer because, you know, maybe because he hadn't paid past child support. You know, they aren't, but you should not have to be, you know, Dudley damn do right in order to have minimum respect, you know, as a human being, and be treated with a minimum degree of respect by state actors who are acting under color of law in the name of us all, right? Police officers, right? So I think Black Lives Matter really went after that politics of respectability approach to civil rights, and it's been fabulously successful, and it's one of the things I'm trying to stress in the book as well, Sam.
Yes, okay. So that raises a couple of other issues, too, is because it seems to me that Barack Obama practice an inordinate amount of respectability politics, that there was, and which makes a lot of sense in the context of the way that he was viewed and what he was supposedly represented, et cetera, et cetera. And I wonder how much of BLM's of that change, of that understanding of, like, you know, because when I hear the respectability politics, as you describe it in the context of this, of the civil rights struggle, there is a, I guess a, a parallel track of like clean for Gene, right? Like that was happening at the time too, but it was within the context of the white world. And it was not in some ways weaponized in the way to cleave off, although there is still, you know, still have this concept of hippie punching, I guess, within the context of the Democratic Party, but it was still not weaponized in the exact same way that it's been weaponized in the black community. And where you have Barack Obama saying, like, you know, the real problem is that black men have to deal with their kids, or, you know, you got to be your brother's keeper stuff. And it creates this dynamic that, like, you know, if there was a white version of Barack Obama, that guy, like, you know, like you could only be Barack Obama if you were that version of a person, right? Incredibly articulate, amazingly eloquent, good looking, you know, just all that has the great story, et cetera, et cetera. You can attain what Barack Obama did, obviously, if you're far less sort of, I guess, of a person than Obama. I mean, look at Donald Trump or this, but that's the whole point, right? Is that like, you're not being measured in the same, within the same spectrum, I guess.
I couldn't agree more. I really agree. Barack Obama really illustrates the limits of respectability politics approaches to social problems and civil rights for black folks in, you know, the modern times, because a lot of people after his election were talking about we're in a post-racial America, right? And it was on his watch that Black Lives Matter was birthed, right? And it's because of the kinds of limits that were on his version of change and progress. And, you know, you're right. He did go down to Morehouse and at their graduation lecture these, you know, graduating young black men who had exhibited great personal responsibility to get to graduation day, irrespective of whatever, you know, one of the most respected black, historically black colleges in the country. They worked hard to get there. And he lectured them on, you know, not making excuses and embracing personal responsibility. He didn't lecture the, you know, other college students when he was at other campuses, when he wasn't talking to black, you know, predominantly black audiences, right? So yeah, you know, that politics of respectability way of thinking about things is holding us back. And we're never going to be able to make, this is one of the other main points in this book, Sam, we're never going to make deep cuts in racialized mass incarceration from that perspective, because contrary to what Michelle Alexander said in The New Jim Crow, most incarceration is not driven by low-level nonviolent drug offenders. Most people in state prisons, which is where 87% of prisoners reside, most of them are there for violent and serious offenses. It would be so much easier if they were just low-level nonviolent drug offenders. Yes, we could all come to an easy consensus on, yes, we should release them, right? What makes deep cuts and racialized mass incarceration so challenging is that isn't the case, factually, right? And that's what I'm trying to correct, that factual error at the heart of Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow, that really it's low-level nonviolent drug offenders that accounts for the explosion from 1980 of 300,000 prisoners to 2.2 million in the aughts. No, it's violent offenders and serious offenders. That's a sad reality. And we need a new moral framework, a new compass, a new politics, and a new a way of thinking about law to accommodate that reality if we really want to make deep cuts in racialized mass incarceration.
So it's basically the challenging the notion that this is going to be easy and fit into sort of a that there is, it's questioning the it's basically saying that the injustice is not in, I guess, you know, who is in prison. The injustice is in what society has constructed, that the prisons are sort of like a second order, almost manifestation of that problem that is being obscured. If you only look at like, there's only low level of, you know, that you're worried about the low level of offenders.
Yes, it makes it allows you to achieve deep cuts in mass incarceration on the cheap. And I'm saying you can't do it on the cheap. You know, you're going to have, you can't do it comfortably within your conventional moral framework. You're going to have to move away from retribution, retaliation, and revenge as your primary way of thinking about violent and serious offenders, which is how we've been doing it for the last 30, 40, 50 years, and move toward restoration, redemption, reconciliation, rehabilitation, right? That's a kind of fundamental shift. You're going to have to tame the retributive urge that you feel to punish, you know, wrongdoers. I'll give you one quick example, Sam. When Amber Geiger shot Botham John, a young black man sitting in Dallas, and she was a white police officer, came in the wrong apartment. He was eating ice cream, stepped it up, shot him dead. She made a negligent mistake. She thought she was going into her apartment. She was on the wrong floor, right? I'll go in and say that was a negligent, stupid mistake, right? But a lot of people on my timeline elsewhere were saying, you know, she deserves a murder conviction, which is what she ultimately got. And I was saying, well, you know, manslaughter, I think, would be enough. Really, it was dumb, you know, it was, you know, but for negligent and even reckless homicides, typically manslaughter is what we do. And I understand the urge because you have a victim from a socially marginalized group and you have a victimizer from kind of a dominant group. And you want to, you know, show that you care for the victim's rights by, you know, punishing the victimizer as much as possible. But we're never going to make deep cuts in mass incarceration if we have that attitude toward Amber Geiger, because it's going to hurt more blacks than non-blacks, because blacks are the ones disproportionately swept up in the criminal justice system. So we have to tame that retributive urge, even when it hurts, even when we don't want to a lot of time, even when it's victimizers from more dominant groups, we still have to work on a new moral compass.
Okay. So if frankly though, I mean, I can hear a lot of people saying like, okay, you know, why should we, right? I mean, from why should we as a society, you know, not have some measure of like to be overly, to be oriented in that way towards people who commit violent crime? Like, why should we?
Right. That's exactly it. You know, for a long time, we say, look, these are people who are sometimes preying on the most vulnerable members of their own society, of our own community, right? Why shouldn't we just, you know, treat them as so much toxic human waste and dump them and forget about them, right? We tried that for 30 years, Sam, and look at what it got us, right? We haven't been making progress with these problems. For one thing, these people do come back out eventually, right? And we want them to come back out and be, you know, feel like they have a stake in our society still, that they have something to get up for and to strive for. And so, you know, I hear that, but I also recognize that what I hear people saying all the time is redemption, reconciliation, you know, restoration, especially from in my faith, Sam, you know, my mother was Catholic. I was raised in that tradition of, you know, on Sunday mornings, you're talking redemption, reconciliation, restoration. And then Monday through Saturday, people go back to retribution, retaliation, and revenge. Right. And then Sunday, they're redemption, restore. I want to take Sunday from that my tradition and spread it throughout the week, you know, have the same moral compass throughout the week.
Wait, so is it a moral argument or is it an efficacy argument? Because, or is it both?
Good, both. It's absolutely both. I sometimes I have to make the efficacy argument to folks who aren't really can't get to the moral argument, because a lot of times some of the studies I go into the book suggest that you don't really feel like making allowances for someone unless you empathize with them. And at an unconscious level, we just don't empathize with black people, right? If you're not, I have these studies, like when you look at what happened in Hurricane Katrina with those black people standing on those rooftops for 4 days with water up to their neck, not 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, Sam, 4 days in, Sean Penn was rolling in, handing out fresh water because FEMA still couldn't get its act together. Compare that response. Those black lives didn't matter. They didn't generate empathy. They didn't generate a panic of empathy. Compare that response to what happened after 9/11 when those planes ran into those buildings. There was a panic of empathy for those victims. Nobody wanted to hear about any red tape, you know, bureaucratic impediments. We just got it done, right? And that's what, you know, is really depressingly coming out of these studies that I look at in this book, that when I walk down Skid Row here in L.A., for example, the fiercest expression of structural violence in America, Sam, the highest concentration of homeless folk in America, you look around you, 75% of the faces are black. Not people of color, black. And that's basically Hurricane Katrina. You have families out there, tents over there. That's basically people in the Ninth Ward with water up to the neck, not just for 4 days, for year after year, right? And we don't have any panic of empathy for them. And that's that. And it's at the level of the unconscious, and I talk about that.
So if I was to accept the efficacy argument and the moral argument, or one or the other, frankly, for that matter, how does this play out in a policy level? How does it play out? I mean, you're an attorney as well. I mean, how does this play out in a courtroom perspective? I know that, like, you know, you touch on the challenge of how you must approach a jury to get them to sort of recognize that they're dealing with a human being, essentially. But how does this play out in the context of policy? Like, what if we did as a society more or less come to the idea of, like, okay, yeah, this is horribly inefficient. This is not working. And fall-on effects from this. And to a certain extent, we should talk about your dad on some level as well. But, like, you know, when we put these people away, it's not efficient, but it also creates a lot of suffering that's going on, you know, that ripples out from this. And it implicates individuals and family members and then the broader community and whatnot. It's also, you know, expensive, and then there's the moral argument. How do we address that from a policy standpoint?
Great. I think starting from a morality standpoint, first and foremost, when we accept that we cannot really judge another's just desserts. I make all kinds of arguments on why we should have epistemic humility about our capacity to judge another's subjective culpability, their just desserts. Once we accept that epistemic humility, number one, then we have to end the death penalty, right? Because, you know, doubt, Sam, may give your dinner a funny taste, but it's the lack of doubt that goes out and kills. It's the lack of doubt that straps a bomb on a back and walks into a middle of a crowd and detonates. And it's the lack of doubt that straps down a citizen in a chair and injects them with it, you know, with gas or in some other kind of way. So, number one, get rid of the death penalty. Number two, Sam, I'm going to be practical. You know, I would say that whatever the crime, I don't care what the crime is. I'm sorry to say it, but whatever the crime, at 12 years, you get a parole hearing. That doesn't mean you get out in 12 years. At 12 years, you get a parole. In Europe and even here in years past in the United States, we had a much different kind of punishment schedule. You know, we've let it go through the roof. You know, we hand out 25 to life like they're, you know, candy from a Pez dispenser, you know, on the bench with that gavel. And so, you know, those kind of concrete interventions are the kind of thing, Sam.
I think people would be surprised to hear, like, is it typical that people don't get a parole hearing in the first, like, 10, 12 years?
Oh, yeah. They can go 25, 35, 45 before they even think about seeing a parole board. They may never see a parole board, right, in other cases, right, period. So many cases, actually. So, you know, that it is, I understand, you know, let me just put it this way. I understand how much we feel the suffering of the victim. I took my students up to San Quentin. I take them used to on a regular basis. And we sit down with lifers without parole, mothers of murder victims for a day. And here's how it would go, Sam. The mothers of murder victims, the session would go, stand up and say, this is my loved one ripped from me by murder. Somebody like you in this room, right? And this is what it did to our family. And it's heartrending. And she'll pass the pictures around and things like that. And we'll sit there with that, Sam. And then when the lifers will stand up, and let's say he has 10 minutes, he'll spend the first 5 minutes saying, here's the person who I killed. And here's the family I tore apart by that death. And we'll pass that picture around if we have some. We'll sit with that. And then he'll take his last 5 minutes to say, the person who did that act was a depraved individual. Let me tell you how I became that depraved individual. Let me tell you about the foster tear. Let me tell you about the cigarette burn. Let me tell you about being put in a car trunk for 6 hours at a time for discipline. Let me tell you about the molestation. Let me tell you about how I got to be that person. And we sit there, Sam, and we realize that the distinction between victims and victimizers isn't so clear. You know, hurt people, right? And that kind of nuance, we feel the victim's pain. We feel everyone's pain. That's what we got to strive for to really achieve justice in our criminal justice system. That's what I'm trying to get at in this book.
And how do we intervene in the construction of that lifer before they become a lifer? Like, how do we not construct someone who is going on to be a victimizer?
Right. We lift them out of those criminogenic conditions before they produce crime. Right. If you have stomach rumbling, Sam, you know, and you don't know where your next meal is going to come from, temptation is much more likely to compel you to do something that's outside the boundaries of the law. If we all want a safer society, we've decided that we're going to achieve a safer society. We decided this. Oh, maybe in after the Great Society experiments of the 60s, we decided that we are going to solve, instead of addressing our social problems head on, we're going to cut the social safety net like Clinton did in the 90s and spend more at the same time on police and jails. Right. And so we're going to use the criminal law to deal with poverty. Our poverty governance is we're going to use police and batons and jail cells to address poverty issues rather than making us all safer by making sure we have affordable housing, that we don't have crumbling schools, that we have adequate health care for everyone. And instead of bringing down crime in that way, that's also a safety measure. We spend on more police and more jails and more prisons. Right. And because we don't see the connection between our basic social structure and those crimes, you know, a lot of times we just say those are bad people making bad choices rather than we've plunked them down in a situation where all they have is bad choices.
I mean, in many respects, this dynamic is analogous to the way that we look towards education and frankly, healthcare on some level too. It's like we create circumstances that are going to cause problems and then try and fix them on the back end. Very often people make profit off of, and whatnot. Just, before we go, just tell your story, if you would, of your father and which I think has informed your perspective on this. And I don't know, you would know better than I, obviously, but I think in many ways, you know, led you to this trajectory of your career and your life.
Absolutely, Sammy did. You know, my dad, when I was 8 years old, speaking of family separation has been going on as part of the American criminal justice process for many decades, right? I lost my dad when I was 8 years old when police kicked in our door and arrested him. He was convicted for a possession sale of marijuana and given 22 to 55 years. He was looking at, really rotting in a jail cell because he was going to be one of those uppity black men who was going to do all 55, right? So his only exit was to reach up on the warden's own law library shelves, pull down law books about criminal law, constitutional law, and criminal procedure, teach himself all of those subjects, writing his own writs of habeas corpus and representing himself pro se up through the state system, through the federal system, until I was standing next to him as a 14-year-old when he was in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati, which is where the Underground Railroad came up, by the way. You know, black bodies in bondage found freedom there. Well, my dad was a black body in bondage who found freedom in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeal when he made his own argument to an en banc panel of judges. And I now teach his case in my criminal law course. It's called Armour versus Salisbury. And it stands for the proposition that a DA cannot intentionally and deliberately lie to a jury to get a conviction against the defendant. So that is what he's taught me, the power of word work, Sam. At the end of the day, all he had was language. And at the end of the day, using words, putting words in the right order, his cell door was flung open, found the key to his own jail cell in the warden's law books.
It's an amazing story. And I wonder, and just as a side note, and I guess, well, what do you make of what we're seeing? It's very nascent, but it's real.
the reform movement amongst prosecutors. You have Krasner in Philadelphia, Chiesa Boudin in San Francisco.
Yes.
There are others too, I think that are escaping. What is your sense of that?
It's a sea change, Sam. I'm so heartened by it because they're only there because the voters put them there. Larry Krasner got 75% of the vote in Philadelphia in the general election, having never prosecuted a case in his life, been a public defender and defense attorney, and running on the following platform: in cash bail, address police misconduct, in mass incarceration. And he got 75% of the vote. Chiesa Boudin, you know, one up in San Francisco, as you said. So that I have more faith in the voters than ever right now when it comes to these issues, more actually than in some of the politicians who have to catch up to some of the voters now.
All right. And lastly, obviously, we just lost a Supreme Court justice. I'm curious as to your perspective on that, if you have anything to add. I mean, it's not necessarily right in your portfolio, but I imagine there will be there's very likely going to implicate your work. There are going to be findings by that Supreme Court ultimately that are going to implicate what you do. What's your sense of where we're at and how, I guess, maybe just in terms of like, when something like this happens, do you start to think that like, the reforms are going to have to come statutorily and politically because this door has been shut for, you know, generations?
That's exactly it. You know, rather than curse the gloom, Sam, I prefer to light a match and think about the fact that the Supreme Court hasn't actually done as much as people think to promote racial justice, right? After Brown versus Board of Education, we had Brown versus Board of Education, great, you know, integration, great. Look at where we still are, Sam, you know, look at Skid Row, as I was telling you, look at our prisons, look at the income gap between blacks and whites hasn't actually improved over 50 years, you know, and wealth and all kinds of other measures. So the Supreme Court route isn't necessarily the one to put all your eggs in anyway, or even a lot of them. Getting in on the local level, the local local DA's race, the local sheriff's race, the city council race, that's where the action really is. And I think this will help focus attention there, hopefully.
Professor Jody David Armour, the book is The N-Word Theory, Race, Language, Unequal Justice, and the Law. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you. All right, folks. We will take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program. We've got a lot to talk about, obviously. You know, we're going to be context of some things. I think, you know, criminal justice reform and racial equality is one of those things that I think it has to happen within the context of society and has to happen statutorily to a large extent. I think addressing some of the underlying issues of why, of how it is that we end up constructing criminals essentially as a society and the underlying structures that we have in terms of our problems with our education or in the context of our healthcare. Supreme Court's not necessarily going to help, but they can certainly hurt. You know, I don't know what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act. It's conceivable that if it is struck down, that the next bite out of the apple is going to be far more aggressive. I would hope if that is the case. I mean, I hope it either way, but it's also conceivable that a 5-4, a 6-3 Supreme Court could simply say, yeah, no, Medicare for all, that's not constitutional. So, scary times we're headed into, never mind the implications for the election in and of itself. So, very disturbing times. We will talk about Nancy Pelosi. There are two separate issues here. What can Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer do to
to stop the appointment of another justice. It's limited, but there are scenarios that could maybe work. They have to be balanced against losing the election, right? Because you lose the election, it doesn't matter if you stop the pick before the inauguration, if Donald Trump becomes president. But there are things that I think Nancy Pelosi can try in terms of saving the Affordable Care Act. We will talk about that in the fun half. We will also talk about some of the individual races around the country. That is going to be implicated, particularly the Senate ones. We will look at maybe some different reactions to this. And Donald Trump, meanwhile, is out and about doing these, you know, big rallies, some inside. We'll see. We will take a quick break. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free half of the program, and you also get extra content every day. So become a member today. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, we have swag. Now, Brendan is back, and so he's the first thing on his docket is he's so obsessed about those pencils. It's crazy. He's going to check on those. But if you go to shop.majorityreportradio.com, you can check out our swag. Also, the AM Quickie, amquickie.com, or you can just find the free podcast. It's all free on any of your podcast services, as it were. And don't forget, 3 p.m. today. Is it 3 p.m. today? Or is it, God, I got to get this straight. My head is a mess. The No McKee Show, you can find that at youtube.com/TheNoMcKee Show or patreon.com/TheNoMcKee Show. Also, Jamie, what's happening on the Intifada?
Hello.
Hello.
This week on the Intifada, we had on a friend we met on Twitter. His name's Aaron Thorpe, a.k.a. Posadist Trap God. And we had a very good conversation. This guy is so good. Apparently, he watches The Majority Report. And that's how he found us, which is pretty cool.
I follow him on Twitter.
And I was not laughing at the Posadist Trap God. It's a funny handle.
It's good, right? He's
I think it's funny that
guy.
Sam knows. I think it's funny that Sam knows what all those words mean.
I mean, I'm not sure I do, frankly, but I sort of do.
That's enough. He's really cool. I thought his tweets were pretty good. I thought they were, shall we say, epic. I never saw a tweet from him I thought was cringe. So we had him on, and we talked about the Supreme Court stuff a little bit. We talked about the city of Atlanta, where he lives. We talked about the black misleadership class and some of his views on that. And we also talked about what's up with all these white people pretending to be black. So I think it was a very good episode that's coming out on Wednesday. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Are there a lot of people doing that? Or is it just like, I know there was that most recent woman they found.
I think several is the...
There have been three so far, but two of them just happened in the last few weeks or so. So perhaps
it was two in the last few weeks.
Yeah, the trend is accelerating. So
or people are getting caught at a more rapid rate.
Yeah, maybe.
Matt.
On TMBS this week, we have assistant professor at the University of Utah for economics, Marshall Steinbaum. We're going to have him on to talk about why we should distrust calls for sectoral bargaining coming from moderate Republicans and sort of corporatist Democrats. And we're going to talk about...
Joe Lieberman's son
maybe responsible for the loss in Georgia.
Yeah.
That's God.
We should have him on. Brendan, we should book him.
Well, yeah.
Lieberman's son.
Yeah. That could be a funny interview.
Life imitates art.
I mean, you played him once. Tech, but we're also going to be talking to Marshall about tech buying academic legitimizers. And then the real reason I want him on, we're going to talk about how Nancy McLean was right. All that and more at patreon.com/TMBS. Also, twitch.tv/literary hangover. I took to the skies in Flight Simulator over the weekend. So, that was pretty fun.
All right. I you're in the skies. Folks, quick break. Fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks! Fucking reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them.
Homo says what?
What?
Homo says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. African. And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black.
Come on! Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total
pussy.